For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
So good morning, everyone. I am really pleased to be here talking to you today, and I'm especially pleased to be here because coincidentally, this place that I'm at right now is where I got the idea for this talk, and my Zazen this morning just, you know, kind of gave me more to talk about. I want to talk to you today about a particular koan. I'm going to be talking about case 22 from the Mumonkan or Gateless Gate, which is on Kashapa's flagpole. The Mumonkan is a 13th century collection of koans compiled by Wumen Weikai or Mumon Eikai, who was a contemporary of Dogen's but was in the Rinzai lineage. And so that's just a little bit of background. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read the case. I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the history of the, well, main players in this case, and then we'll talk a little bit. So the case goes, Ananda asked Kashapa in all earnestness, the world-honored one transmitted the brocade robe to you. What else did he transmit to you? Kashapa called, Ananda! Ananda replied, yes, master. Kashapa said, knock down the flagpole at the gate. So I'll read that one more time. Ananda asked Kashapa in all earnestness, the world-honored one transmitted the brocade robe to you. What else did he transmit to you? Kashapa called, Ananda! Ananda replied, yes, master. Kashapa said, knock down the flagpole at the gate. I will also read you Mumon's initial commentary. And the commentary is this. If you can give a turning word befitting this, you will see that the meeting at Mount Gurdwakuta is definitely still in session. If not, it is because Vipassana Buddha has been keeping something in mind from the remotest times, and even now he still cannot attain the mystery. So let me tell you a little bit about who these people are for those who may not know. Ananda was born as the cousin of Shakyamuni Buddha. He also served as his attendant for many years. And Kashapa is short for Mahakashapa, who was the Dharma heir of Buddha. And there's another koan in the Gateless Gate or Mumonkan, number 6, Buddha holds up a flower. And I'll read that to you too, just so you have, you will remember this story. But it goes, once in ancient times, when the world-honored one was at Mount Gurdwakuta, he held up a flower, twirled it, and showed it to the assemblage. At this, they all remained silent. Only the venerable Kashapa broke into a smile. The world-honored one said, I have the eye treasury of the true Dharma, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of no form, the subtle gate of the Dharma. It does not depend on letters, being specially transmitted outside all teachings. Now I entrust Mahakashapa with this. So that was the first transmission of Buddha Dharma. And whether anything was transmitted or not, I think sometimes we think of it as more just a recognition that someone else recognized something that someone else saw. And that's important in life, you know, that we can share our viewpoints. And I'll get into that more a little bit later. So Buddha, as we say it in kind of how we normally talk, Buddha transmitted Dharma to Kashapa. And when we chant the names of Buddhas and ancestors, they are very close to the beginning. Ananda was known for his prodigious memory. And you may hear, he memorized actually all of the sermons of Buddha. And so when you read or chant a sutra, it often starts with, thus have I heard. That's the voice of Ananda. So when so it's present in almost every sutra that we read. And so Ananda studied with Shakyamuni Buddha for many years. And then following Buddha's death, Ananda studied under Kashyapa and awakened. But even after his awakening, he continued to practice for many years with Kashyapa and believed that his awakening and Kashyapa's awakening and all the Buddhas and patriarchs were one and the same experience for a long time. But gradually, he began to have some doubts about this, and he started to wonder if something was lacking in his own understanding, which is what led to this particular exchange. And in this exchange, when he asks the question, Kashyapa calls out, Ananda! And Ananda replies, yes, master. And Kashyapa says, knock down the flagpole at the gate, which may mean that this discussion is over. With just this little exchange, this discussion is over. Nothing remains. The flagpole is not necessary. It may also mean, you know, let go of your concepts. Let go of the concepts that you're holding on to. The flagpole was put up whenever Buddha was giving a talk, and was taken down as a way of, you know, kind of letting people know, you know, come here, there's a talk going on, and was taken down when the talk was over. And so in terms of the commentary, he talks about the meeting at Mount Gurdjieffkuta still in session. That's where the ancients were practicing and preaching. And Mumon is saying, if you can say a turning word, it means that the meeting is still in session. This ancient exchange is still going on, just as it was in Shakyamuni's time. And if not, it's because Vipassana Buddha still has something in mind. Vipassana Buddha was the first Buddha before Buddha. Can you still hear me above the plane? Okay. So Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, was actually considered to be the seventh Buddha. And so when we chant the Buddhas and ancestors, we start off with great teacher Vipassana Buddha and go on to great teacher Shikin Buddha, great teacher Vishvabhu Buddha, great teacher Krakuchanda Buddha, great teacher Kunigun Muni Buddha, great teacher Kashyapa Buddha, great teacher Shakyamuni Buddha. And then we begin to chant great teacher Mahakashyapa, great teacher Ananda, great teacher Shanavasa, and about 90 more names before we get to our present time. And many of these teachers, but not all, were in relationship with their successor and with their predecessor. And so there's something important about relationships that's built into our lineage, for sure, and our understanding of Zen. You know, we talk about Zen as being transmitted from warm hand to warm hand. And that is very important, it's something that we do together. So Kashyapa calls out, Ananda, and Ananda responds, yes, master. And it makes me, you know, brings me to that phrase, what's in a name? You know, when we're called, we respond automatically. You know, we don't usually choose our names. They're given to us, whether they're given to us by our parents, which for me would be Nancy, or by our teacher, which for me would be Aishin. Somebody else gives us our name. And, you know, even our friends, maybe like, you know, my cousins call me Nan. We answer to many names and we answer to many calls. And what that means is that we're really born into a context. You know, we're given even ourselves, if you believe Western psychology, which as a psychologist I do, within a context of being with others. We recognize in Buddhism that we can't do anything independently. And we're born into this web of names and language and associations. I always remember when during my Shuso ceremony, someone asked me a question and they wanted me to put the Dharma into my own words. And I truly regret that I did not have the presence of mind to say, because my words, you know, I tried to put them into our English, and my words are not my words. My words have been handed down from, you know, centuries. My language, the language that I have, was given to me. It's not mine. And if I said something in my own words, nobody would understand what I say, because that's who we are. We can't even speak. Our language comes from, you know, whatever roots they are, they're beyond the scope of this talk, but you know what I'm getting at. So, you know, this is one way, I guess, in which we can recognize that we're not bringing the Dharma. The Dharma is realizing itself and enacting itself through us, you know, and we have to make it real within our own context. I've been studying Genjo Koan recently with a friend, and the line, to carry the self forward and experience myriad things is delusion. That the myriad things come forth and experience themselves is itself awakening, comes to mind. So, you know, we get glimpses at times that we are part of everything. But we also, and maybe more typically and more conventionally, recognize that we're also individuals occupying a particular place and time, and we are not all the same. We're not in the same place. We're not in the same time. We don't answer to everything. You know, if somebody calls out Richard, I'm very unlikely to turn my head unless they're, you know, yelling it. And in that case, what I'm responding to is the sound. You know, I'm responding to maybe there's a tone of danger in their voice, and that I'm responding to. So I think it's worth paying attention to what we respond to and what we don't. We're in a particular place. We'll be chanting the harmony of difference and sameness later, and there's a line, each of the myriad things has its merit, expressed according to function and place. We don't have to become someone else. You know, we can all awaken together, but as individuals also. So our particular form, the form that we occupy, is at once form, but it's also made of lots of different things. I know Teigen likes to say, you know, who remembers their third grade teacher? Raise your hand if you remember your third grade teacher. I do. Mrs. Long. She did not like me. But anyway, your third grade teacher, if you think about it, is still a part of you. If you know how to multiply things, your third grade teacher is living on within you. Because that's one of the things I remember learning in third grade. So form and emptiness have a relationship with each other, even within ourselves. You know, in this case, I think points out both. We exist in a relationship so that someone can call and someone can respond. And we're separate beings. So someone can call Ananda, and really only Ananda will answer. And I think that this shows us, this koan in particular, shows us something crucial about our essential nature. That this is this is our central dilemma as human beings. You know, how do we balance our responsibility with self and others? So I want to just say a little bit more about relationships. I think I told you that psychology, Western psychology, now believes that we develop our sense of ourself in our relationship with our caregivers, who are themselves part of, you know, our culture. And so our self develops as part of our culture. And as I think maybe most of the people on this call grew up in the United States, we have a very different worldview from someone who grew up in Japan or in China. And This is important because our relationships that determine our sense of ourself, it's not even how we feel about it. It completely impacts what we even think is happening. And this is part of the reason why white folks like me are notoriously bad at recognizing racism when it occurs, because it's not something that we necessarily grew up recognizing. And so we really need the perspectives of people of color to help us get a greater sense of what's happening, to really help all of us together inform our sense of what's happening and what's real. It's not something that we can see on our own. And this is also true about Sangha. You know, this is why Sangha, I think, is one of the three jewels that we don't awaken alone. We really need each other to awaken, that each of us has an incomplete perspective, and we really need other perspectives in order to become more complete. We can't ever fully realize reality, but the more perspectives we can hear from, the more we can be informed about what's real and what's happening. And I guess all that. The view has just shifted to me, and now it's very disconcerting seeing myself on the screen. But anyway, I'm going to try to move past that. I want to talk a little bit about practice. And thank you. Maybe this is something I have control over. No, I don't. okay. So one thing that I've come to recognize is that for me, and I think probably for many or most of us, we tend to hold ourselves as separate. We tend to be very aware of, you know, what I want, what I'm doing, you know, taking care of my own needs. And we need to do this, you know, in order to exist in our four-dimensional world. You know, somebody has to get food, somebody has to eat, somebody has to pay the rent. Nobody can do these things for you. I guess somebody could pay the rent for you, but we need to take care of our individual self. And when we sit down to practice, we get some experience with loosening our boundary between that individual self and the world. And I notice this a lot sitting in nature, which is why I was glad to be here today practicing, as you can see, kind of out somewhat in the woods. It probably looks like it's in the woods, but I'll tell you what's even more enjoyable than practicing in nature. Practicing in nature behind a screen window so that you don't have the bugs and you know, you're not getting bitten by mosquitoes. And that's the central dilemma right there, is how do we allow ourselves to expand and encounter the world when right there in that very moment we think, ew, I don't want to get bitten, you know, let's put up a boundary. So we get to practice with this a lot when we sit in nature. It's also very easy to recognize bird calls when we're sitting out in, you know, the midst of birds, and to recognize them as being a part of me. I don't, and part of what I think helps me to recognize bird calls as being a part of me is that I don't know a lot about birds. And so I don't know what they're saying. Someone like Gyoshin does know a lot about birds, and she knows which birds are speaking and you know, which birds are speaking to which other birds. For me, I don't. So it's a little bit easier to kind of let it wash over me and to feel and recognize that what I consider me is actually much bigger than just what's going on in my body, my own personal sphere. You know, one of the names for Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is in Japanese, Kanzeon, which means hearing the cries of the world. And that is something that we develop in practice. It's our ability to hear the cries of the world and to respond. So, you know, with practice, as we loosen that boundary of the individual self, it becomes easier to see how we're part of the world, you know, where we let it in, where we're resisting. Somebody used the metaphor of waves on the ocean, that we're beings that kind of form for a period of time and then loosen back into the ocean. And we can feel that in practice, and we can feel how that changes over the course of our lives. A few summers ago, one of my cats was in the process of dying, and she was 18 and a half. She was not sick. She was not in pain. But her organs were just starting to fail. And she did a couple of really interesting things that summer. One of which was she sat on my altar for an entire weekend without moving. Half of the time, actually, she did move, because half the time she was facing the Buddha and the other half of the weekend she was facing out, and she really didn't do anything. But she also would sit in, well, she sat in a window also for a couple days also, and it didn't really matter whether it was day, night, whether the sun was coming down on her, whether it was, you know, getting cold. When it got cooler at night, she just got colder. And to me, it seemed like she was beginning to return to the elements a little bit. She was, you know, letting go a little bit, becoming, kind of going back to being kind of a part of everything. And I think that that's maybe something that happens with our consciousness when we practice, and for sure when we pass away. So practice is a way to start to recognize ways in which we are a part of everything, and by extension, how we really are complicit with everything. And we can use practice as a way of increasing our ability to hear the cries of the world and to respond. And so it raises questions that maybe we can talk about during the discussion about how, for each of us, do we want to respond to what's going on in the world? We don't need to become someone else. We can allow others to inform and enlarge our perspective, but we can still respond as ourselves. And so we have questions like, you know, how do we help others? How do we respond to others' pain? How do we respond to the cries of the world? And how do we balance this with our need to take care of the self? You know, how do we do this from our own Dharma position, which is going to be different from anyone else's? So back to the commentary about Vipassana Buddha, you know, keeping something in mind. I think we can think about Vipassana Buddha keeping something in mind as remaining two separate. We don't, you know, we need to find a way to break down that separateness and to be able to let go and, you know, reconstitute moment by moment. So we're opening, we're closing. We can even see this in our breathing. When we breathe, we allow the world in and it's part of us, and then we let it go and we become, you know, kind of come reconstitute back to ourselves. So, you know, the world is calling to us constantly. And I think this koan gives us a little bit to chew on over how do we join the dance? You know, how do we become part of the hopefully helpful movement that's happening in the world? So with that, I will close and hope that we can just have a little discussion. Thank you for being here.
So as host, I'll say that you can raise your hand in the regular way, but since we're not in the same room, that not everyone will be aware of it. If you're not visible on the screen, you can use the participants button at the bottom.
Maybe I need to move so I can see the participants. Okay, there we go.
David, you might want to tell people how to use that, if they go to
the... Sure. There's a button at the bottom. If you see participants, mine shows that there are 31. And then when I click on that, I'll find my name, and I can then raise my hand there. I can also click on the...
For me, there's a raise hand button at the bottom of the participant list.
Great. Thank you. Me too. And you can also just unmute. And I see Joe Kai's hand. And then Nicholas.
Hi, Aishin.
Hi, Joe Kai.
Hey. So Ananda's response was perfect. Do you think that Kashyapa had to say anything else?
You know, that's funny, because that's what they go on to talk about in more of the commentary on this koan, that having to explain it or respond is, they kind of equate that to the stink of Zen. Yes, the response was perfect, and they could have both just bowed. It's not necessary to... I had a psychology supervisor who told me, when writing reports, you want to describe, as if you're drawing a horse, you want to fully describe a horse. You just don't write the word horse underneath. So they kind of fully described the relationship. They don't need to write, you know, the description of it underneath. And I saw Nicholas Joyner's hand also.
Yes. Can you hear
me?
Hi,
Nicholas.
Hi.
Good to see your name.
Excuse me?
I said it's good to see your name.
Thank you. Thank you. That was a terrific talk, and I got a lot out of it. One thing you said, the more perspectives we hear from, the more complete is our understanding. I think that's just a beautiful quote, and this idea of what we respond to, and also your comments about language, you know, that words are not my words. And if I ever get asked that question that you referred to, I hope that I can speak in tongues as well and answer it. That'd be a great answer.
I have to confess that my saying that wasn't my own. I heard Reb say it one time at a in a class.
Well, that's a warm hand to warm hand, you know.
Yep, there you go. It's living on.
Yeah. So, and you know, in a way, like your whole talk was kind of about identity, you know, whether it be words or, you know, a flag. Perspectives, you know, and for me, it's a lot of this practice is about letting go, obviously, and just seeing all the ways that we become something and recognizing that's not it either.
Yeah.
Thank you.
As Dogen said, you know, life is mistake after mistake, and yet we have nothing else. You know, the only way we can walk is by always being a little bit out of balance. And if we don't walk, we can't get anywhere. We can't do anything. So everything we do is a little bit out of balance against, you know, what they say is a backdrop of perfect balance. I don't know if it's a backdrop of perfect balance. Sometimes it seems that way, and other times it doesn't.
Mm.
But maybe that's the continuing to walk.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you for being here.
Thank you. And it's just, I'm so grateful and honored to be able to watch your development as a Dharma teacher. And it's fabulous. So thank you.
Thank you. That's really a very kind thing to say, and very humbling. It's been wonderful practicing with you, and I especially appreciated when we were at Tassajara studying the harmony of difference and sameness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll get back there someday.
Oh, I know.
All right. Well, thank you.
Somewhere where we can be in nature.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I will say that that is one of the things that I'm going to be trying to make happen in the fall is to find ways to maybe do something like an all day sitting outside, because which is one of the few things that are safe to do these days. But I'm hoping we can do, you know, an all day sitting outside, and maybe a few so that lots of people can join.
I see David Weiner's hand.
Yeah. I just wanted to echo Nicholas's words and give my appreciation for your talk today, and also to see you grow, you know, from my perspective. And see you blossom as a teacher in this wondrous. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I've needed all of your perspectives to grow as a teacher, and sometimes that's painful when I confront my ignorance. But sometimes it's not painful, like today, or at least so far today. Thank you, David. It's been wonderful practicing with you too, and I've also appreciated all your support for our practice in the natural world.
I see Fushin's hand.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, Fushin.
Thank you. So,
welcome back.
Thank you. The flagpole. Can you say a little bit more about the flagpole? I obviously the response complete, and maybe needs a little bit more to be said about it.
The flagpole doesn't speak to me that much. And I didn't find a lot in the commentary. My very, very limited understanding of the flagpole at this time is that the monks would put the flagpole up when the Buddha was speaking and would take it down when Buddha was not speaking. And so maybe even the allusion to the flagpole was Buddha was speaking when the two of them were calling and responding. Maybe that was an exemplification of Buddha at work. And so whether there was an actual flagpole up or not, maybe just saying knock down the flagpole was a way to recognize that that itself is Buddha, this call and response. Do you have more knowledge about the flagpole?
Maybe Taigen can say something.
One interpretation of the flagpole sometimes given is that goes back to in Tibetan Buddhism, and I think maybe in India. Can you hear me? Okay. That in Tibetan Buddhism, they put up a flagpole when there's a debate, a formal debate going on between the monks. But in some ways, maybe the flagpole could represent Ananda's sense of self, that he had some banner that was, you know, his questioning Mahakashapa. So this is just one interpretation. Yes. What you said was fine. Just this sense of we sometimes carry our identification, our dossier as a banner to wave as, our resume or whatever. So Mahakashapa is saying, get rid of that, let go of the self. that's one way of looking at it.
Thank you, Taigen. You know, I'm also thinking about the fact that I didn't really talk at all about one dimension of this, which was Ananda's sense that he was lacking something, which is what led to this whole conversation or this whole exchange, was that Ananda had for a long time trusted that his awakening and Kashyapa's and Buddha's were one and the same. And yet somehow he developed an idea that he was lacking something, or, you know, a sense of inferiority, which we all can do, you know? and we can get a sense that someone else has it, you know, and we don't have it. And sometimes there's some truth to that. Sometimes there are definitely, there's knowledge that we don't possess. Sometimes there are dimensions that our eye of practice hasn't reached yet. And so we do need others to help us reach those dimensions. But also, or yes, and what we have is what we have, and where we are is where we are. And you know, as Dogen would say, you know, we're, even if when we're half present, we're fully half present. So we're not practicing as a means to get someplace. We're practicing as a means of recognizing our, you know, realization right here in this moment. And so I think that's what Kashapa was trying to help Ananda realize, is that there's, you know, you, yes, there's all that, but yes, you're here, and you're fully yourself right in this moment. And I guess Ananda got it. We knocked down the flagpole. David.
Thank you so much, Aishin, for that talk. Lots of things that I want to ask you about, and maybe that could happen some other time, like language and psychology in relation to the Dharma. But I'd like to ask you about the knocking down, and also that, you know, that sort of almost like powerful and aggression, you know, calling the name. You know, you talked about, you know, that as like having to do, you know, with the little one developing a sense of self. And, you know, Western psychology talks about, like, and I feel that if somebody says David in an aggressive tone, I go to a little boy, and, you know, I feel all kinds of things in my body. And it's like, I don't know, I'm just thinking about like the transmission of Dharma and the relation to practice. And like, is there a dichotomy between, you know, this sort of impactful aha moment that I know some schools of, you know, some schools of Buddhism go for on the one hand, and then the other, the kind of sinking and acceptance and allowing, you know, allowing what is, allowing myself just to be in the moment. That's a question that your talk just brought me back to, the relation between those things.
The aha moment versus sort of the settling.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let me just think for a moment. And how we compose our sense of ourself from the exchanges that we have with others.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I haven't had too many aha moments, except maybe through settling. I do notice that when we call out, you know, maybe especially if we call out aggressively, I haven't noticed that really helps anyone to awaken. I've noticed that what that sometimes tends to do, whether I want it to or not, is it helps people to sort of contract and be like, what the hell? You know, who me? And that's, I think, something that I've appreciated about our Soto Zen school, that we encourage each other to relax. I've found that helping each other and helping create the conditions in which we can relax helps people to open their minds a lot more. And when our minds are open, we're a lot more able to take in, you know, like our recognition of our own unskillful behavior. I will tell you that I once went with my husband to a Zen temple that turned out to be, we're in town, and we're like, oh, there's a Zen center, let's go there. And it turned out it was in the Rinzai tradition. And before we went, my husband, who does not practice and was kind of interested in trying it, said, okay, you know, I don't know what to do. And I said, okay, well, you know, kind of just do what the person next to you does and you'll probably be okay. Well, unfortunately, they came around with a kyosaku and the person next to him put his hands up and, you know, got whacked on the shoulders. And so Rob put his hands up and got whacked on the shoulders, which he was not expecting. And it was not welcome. It was, I know it's kind of humorous, but it really, I mean, he wasn't expecting this. He didn't like it. He didn't want it. He didn't know he was asking for it. And he's never gone back to a Zen center since. And so there's a difference in meaning and intention, you know? And so I guess maybe that experience is welcome if we are anticipating it and we've asked for it. But if we're not, I don't think it really helped him awaken, for sure. So we have to be, you know, judicious in how we help each other awaken. And we have, if we're going to do something harsh, I think we better really, you know, have studied the situation for a while so that we have a sense of what we're doing and what the risks are in what we're doing. Because it can really backfire. And the same thing is true with, you know, when we're very, very young and we're developing ourselves and, you know, does it work better to encourage someone to do something or does it work better to scold them? I think we probably all can remember times that we were scolded where we felt such a feeling of shame and closing down and just, you know, we never want to do that thing again. And, I don't think that's what we're after as Zen practitioners. So there's something to be said for learning how to give each other feedback skillfully. It doesn't mean that there's not a time for anger and protests and a lot of the things that are happening in our modern times, some of which are bearing fruit. You know, I mean, the statue of Columbus in Chicago, in Grant Park in Chicago, was taken down a couple days ago in response to a massive protest, but not exactly, not 100% because of the protest, because what I heard the mayor say was that protesters are being hurt. Police are also being hurt. If taking down a statue can prevent more people from being hurt, then it's worth taking it down. Not exactly because that's what the protesters wanted, but because beings are being harmed. So there's room for all of these things, but I think it's important to continue to study what the effects are of what we do. Sometimes just asking somebody nicely isn't effective either. So there's no one strategy, you know, that works in all situations. That's part of why we practice, and that's part of why we hopefully welcome other perspectives so that we can increase our own, you know, what our own eye of practice can see. I don't know if that answered your question.
Very much, and thank you for that. Aishin, should we have one more question? I see Paul's hand.
Okay, yes.
Thank you very much for your talk.
Thank you for being here, Paul.
I haven't had a chance to practice with you at any length of time, but I see that's my detriment. I realize, you know, how difficult it is to talk about things in words. I think that's what basically we're dealing with here, these koans, is the difficulty of conveying anything in a verbal form. And especially with the East-West difference of understanding, we're getting deep into the study of Dogen's transmitting of Buddhism from China to Japan now in Tenshin Anderson's class. And It's very interesting for me to see how much of that culture that was alive in the 12th century is still alive in Japan. And I know from my personal experience that just to say yes or presence or hi in the Japanese sense of the word made a big impression in the people, the Japanese people in particular. Just to say, when your name is called, just to say yes, I am here, I am present, I'm ready to receive. I think maybe it'd be the more. And I know as a teacher myself, teaching both Buddhism and woodworking, when I find a student that is willing to be receptive in the moment, I'm greatly gratified. Anyway, that's been my experience of that relationship is just to not to put too big a spin on it or make it too complicated, but just to say, yes, I'm here. And it's a profound moment, and it's been recorded obviously for the centuries. But it is actually, when you experience that with teacher and student, I think it's a very profound moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. I agree, and you know, as I will, I know that moment very well. I don't know much about what you're talking about with respect to China and Japan and Dogen's time, but I think you're talking about that same moment that we experience now, that where we see that someone else has led us into their worldview. And it happens as a psychologist as well, that as I relax, whether it's in a conversation with someone or as a psychologist, I become more able to see whether what I'm saying, how what I'm saying is being taken and how it's being received, and get a sense of what I could do or say that would help my message get across. And now that you're saying it that way, I realize that we each have to use different words for different people, that as we study the person that we're talking with, we can see that maybe I need to say it this way for this person and you know, a different way for another person. For you, probably woodworking metaphors go a long way. And for somebody else, maybe, you know, fishing metaphors are better. But there's something very intimate about that moment where we recognize that something we said had an impact on someone. And sometimes that happens right away, and sometimes it happens after many years of practicing together. That is one of the things that people talk about the importance of practicing with a teacher for many years, is that the teacher's way of being becomes who we are. And ideally, something from Suzuki Roshi, who I never knew, you know, comes down through, you know, my teacher and my teacher's teacher. And so there's something there. That's maybe the warm hand to warm hand. Thank you so much for being part of the talk.